This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're going to talk about in this episode include...
Gen Con Scuttlebutt.
Setting the scene.
Halfling Breakfasts.
And Michael Aquino.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
The sound of announcements at the airport, the fear of cancellations, tell us that we're once more in a travel advisory. And this time around, the travel that has happened has been Ken at Gen Con with the rest of the U.S. Pelgrane contingent and pals. And we used to, when we were both able to go, do a whole episode on Gen Con. But since only you were there, I'll have to get a condensed form of scuttlebutt from you. So what will you most of all remember this Gen Con for? And was it a flood and a tornado?
Well, let's just say that unless Jupiter Pluvius really picks up his game, I think that this is going to be the most memorable weather Gen Con. We did have a tornado warning on Saturday, which was exciting for everyone who did not grow up in Tornado Alley, as I did. And so this is, you know, look, there are eggs in the pantry. This is a breakfast warning. That's what tornado warning means. So we were all very excited to see everyone sort of perk their heads up. And then about the 19th time the announcement came over, everyone was getting a little blasé about it. And that's when Jupiter really held up his end of the bargain by drenching Indianapolis with torrential rain that flooded the inside of Hall B. People were apparently gaming. And you know how wags will often say, gosh, I wish these people would take a shower. Well, the monkey's paw curled and rain poured in on the gamers. There was very little damage. No one lost a ton of product, I don't think. It was mostly the sort of natural disaster and failed ceiling that you can laugh at as opposed to the one that you rail against. So as messages from the gods go, it was a pretty hail fellow well met shoulder slap kind of message, but it was fun. I mean, you know, it breaks up the day a little bit. They would all say, go to an interior room. And the customers from other states than Oklahoma would say, are we okay? I said, this is an interior room. You will note the absence of windows in it.
Yeah. But,
oh, okay. So that was good fun. And avoid the docks. Don't go out onto the docks. It's like, was not going to do that. Thank you, announcement.
Due to my policy of avoiding the loading dock at all times, I will continue to avoid the loading dock.
General advice at all times, yes. So apparently other areas were more disrupted, like there was a puppetry demo that went from 4 people in the audience to 204 people in the audience because they were doing it in an inner room next to a hallway. So that was, I guess, good for the puppet people. There was, you know, any number of fun little stories like that, I'm sure. And I hope that at least one meet cute happened as a result of this. But mostly it was a meet wet, I think.
Yeah. I guess the year of the flood is better than the year everybody got COVID. So that's a plus there.
Yeah. Better for me, certainly. And like some of the hotels also had some flooding, like the Omni, I think, got water coming in places that the Omni did not expect water to come in. But again, I was on the floor. I was in an interior room. I was under the part of the roof that still worked. And I was from a state that the response to a tornado warning is, do we have a pickup and a case of beer?
Yeah.
So we did not, in fact, have a pickup and a case of beer, though, Robin. So we were in that way woefully underprepared. And I'm going to bring that up at the next Gen Con planning meeting.
And this has been your mini segment, Ken Height, Old Tornado Hand.
Old Tornado Hand. If people like the character, please request more, and we can talk about tornadoes.
More of the guy with the blasé attitude about tornadoes.
Yep.
Now, I think there has been if I detect from a distance, there's been an interesting trend. For a little while there weren't a lot of big product announcements at Gen Con in particular, because for a good stretch there, Wizards of the Coast was sort of stepping back from making a big deal of things at Gen Con, but I think a number of big deals were made. Not only, I think they ramped up their Magic the Gathering presence, but I hear there was a big announcement.
Yeah, there was. And I guess the little announcement is that the rumor is that Wizards is going to be coming back to the hallway with a booth and a footprint next year. And that is one of the reasons that I believe Gen Con is talking about making the exhibit hall even bigger. And I hope they add zip lines. That's my hope. But
or maybe like those cable cars at amusement parks, like an Alpine Way.
Right. Yeah, we could have a funicular. I think a funicular would really pull the whole room together. Magic the Gathering has for a long old time been both Magic the Gathering, beloved card game that enjoyed by millions, and also a licensed brand opportunity. And so I don't know, because I don't play Magic and I certainly don't run a game store, but there's been like Spider-Man Magic and all kinds of other Magic that are, you know, not particularly relevant to Dominaria or the fantasy world of Magic the Gathering. Some of these sets
The whole Hasbro policy of taking big IPs and doing them in Monopoly has for many years now been part of Magic.
Yeah. And as again, not a Magic guy, so I don't know if Magic players by and large are happy to see their card game making money or angry that they have to deal with people with a deck full of Spider-Man. But either way, it's now in D&D. So if you were sitting back on your polyhedrals and snorking, well, now it's D&D's turn to get Universes Beyond. That's the official name for it. So if they announced at this show World of Warcraft, I believe, for next year, and Star Wars for the year after that, or maybe World of Warcraft for later this year and Star Wars for 27. I don't know. It was something like that. So those are the two bigs. And then I assume at some level, once we've all become inured to it, we'll get Spider-Man D&D, which will be an interesting choice because I think Marvel is still their exclusive comics licenses with someone else. So maybe they can do a sub deal with Sony or something. But anyway, at any moment, Sex in the City D&D coming to a table near you. Very exciting.
It'll be interesting to find out how far from the core design of D&D that these things are going to be in order to serve their licenses, whether they're going to be.
I don't know that World of Warcraft needs a lot of change. I think Star Wars will have to do violence either to the property or the game. And as the history of Star Wars adaptations has shown, I think people are willing to do that violence.
Right.
So we'll see.
But also, I'd imagine head office at Hasbro doesn't care one whit.
Not
what the actual mechanics are if it says D&D on it. So it could be bear little resemblance to D&D and be called D&D Star Wars, and they would be very happy as long as it sells.
I think that would make the most creative and interesting choice, which makes me suspect it will not be the choice made. They are also, for the olds, they are bringing back Tracy Hickman and I believe Margaret Weiss to do a new Dragonlance book. There's going to be new Ravenloft material that's done by a third-party publisher. If you recall, some time ago, Green Ronin did part of the Forgotten Realms, I believe the Sword Coast. And now Kobold Press will be doing part of the Forgotten Realms, so that'll be exciting. So we'll see more D&D support. It looks like their tacit policy of ignoring third-party publishers has once more become the policy of we need stuff for core IP. Oh, look at these people who are actually good at their jobs. We should get them to do it.
Right, because recently in an interview, that CEO of Hasbro said 60% of D&D's revenue is now digital. And one way to achieve that is by having a big resurgence in digital. And the other is to not publish anything, to have other people publish it. And so if you're only publishing the core books, statistically speaking, your PDF sales are a big, it sounds great to say that in a meeting. It sounds so much more exciting than we're not really publishing anything anymore.
And then I take it a lot of the other renewed stuff of this old IP will be to get more eyes on whatever the D&D Beyond version of Ravenloft is. When the new Ravenloft comes out, people will say, well, I might as well pick up Curse of Strahd since I'm picking up this new Ravenloft thing. So it's a good way to draw interest to these, in many cases, quite wonderful IPs that have been allowed to flourish in neglect. And then, speaking of old IPs that have been neglected, they announced Dark Sun is coming back. And their selling point, and I leave it to others to determine whether or not this is a selling point, but their selling point that they announce in the meeting, in the announcement, is that it was so full of sex and ultra-violence that their lawyers advised them to shrink wrap it. So this is the marketing for your Dark Sun. People who went to Dark Sun for the world building or for the intriguing politics of resistance that Dark Sun presented, maybe you'll also get that. Who can say? But definitely what you're going to get is a shrink wrap thumbnail and sex and ultraviolence. So I guess the people who are wishing for Dark Sun, we don't know if that was a monkey's paw or not, but something is curling for them. And I guess I hope that it's what they wanted in their darkest and sunniest hearts.
Right. So this would be the Richard Corbin 70s van art version of Dark Sun.
I would buy that version, frankly. So cross fingers, everybody.
And so I remember back in the original day at Gen Con, there was a period there where the big news was dueling announcements between TSR and White Wolf. And we have a little bit of that today because there was a World of Darkness announcement.
Yes, the new version of Vampire V6, Vampire 6th Edition, has been being teased and it is now announced. They put up the alpha playtest document on Demiplane and people can download it from there. And they were running demos, a lot of demos at the hall. They had a big Where We Are with Vampire come to the set meeting on Thursday. And that was a lot of the energy in the hall was people talking about New Vampire. And did they like New Vampire? Were they angry about New Vampire? And I'll tell you what, it took me back. It was a real moment. So I did get to meet and congratulate Diogo Nogueira, the new game lead designer on Vampire 6th. And we did an interview, which will no doubt be on this very podcast at some time in the future. Not this podcast episode, but Ken and Robin, we will contain a Diogo interview. And he, you know, has a big job ahead of him. And I wish him all the best. And certainly, given his sort of, this is not his first Gen Con, thank God, so he didn't have to deal with that. He'd come a number of other times. So we have a new vampire in town. And Robin, you'll be excited to know that one of the reasons they're selling a new vampire is that old V5 was for the surveillance state era. Well, this vampire is for the post-truth era. So this is a topic that is near and dear to your heart, the complete collapse of all independent standards and everything. And the new V6 apparently will be taking advantage of that because if a vampire tears someone's throat out live on TV, everyone can say, that's just AI. And so the masquerade takes on a fun new shape and for a fun new decade.
Well, Dracula's been hypnotizing people and changing their reality for a long time. So that,
exactly.
That certainly makes sense. Now, another sort of epical moment that tells us about the direction of the game industry, the impact of streaming on tabletop role-playing games is not new. It's been enormously influential for a long time, but I think it's sort of reached its apex at the Ennies.
It has indeed. The big winners at the Ennies were Daggerheart, which won 4 gold Ennies, including best game, best rules, best streaming content for a Daggerheart stream, although I don't believe it's a fantasy Daggerheart. I think it's a horror Daggerheart stream. And a silver Ennie for product of the year. and Evantris, which is began as a streaming channel for Ravenloft content and has moved into their own universe. And the game of that universe is called Crooked Moon. And Crooked Moon won 5 golds, best digital and non-digital aid. The best non-digital aid was a tarot deck, which makes my heart so happy, not least because it was done by Elisa Teague, who is great and deserves all the Emmys. Best production values. The book is gorgeous. Product of the year, beating out Daggerheart. So that must have been a lot of flurrying on the message boards back in the day. And Evantris won fan favorite publisher, which is an indication of how interested is your audience in the Emmys more than it is anything else, but it is an indication. And with both of them, you know, basically competing at silver and gold level throughout the Emmys, we are looking at a situation where the Emmys, being a popularly voted award, is now, I think, seeing the real effects of the audiences of these YouTube channels and streams that is in the, in many cases, millions and certainly in the hundreds of thousands. And we are now in a situation where if the beloved and charismatic star of Crooked Moon comes on and says, "Hey, everyone, we're in the Emmys. We'd appreciate your vote. Here's the link." That's got a bigger effect than if the lovely and charismatic head of Kobold Press comes on a blog and says it. So this is a big sea change in the Emmys. And I think also it is a real moment that we look at that the creative direction of the industry, because of course you and I, Robin, are all, well, the streamers are all well and good and they're, you know, playing our games and this is wonderful. Well, now everyone is playing the streamers' games and that's an interesting choice. And a lot of the people doing these designs, some of them are experienced designers, others are from the world of streaming and are doing the sort of world building stuff that you and I specialize in. And that's an interesting change in the direction of the industry as well. And I'm sure that if I had been in more bars, I was in relatively few bars this Gen Con, personal failing of mine, I know, I would have probably had more to say about it and a lot more to hear about it. But I'll bet that was the scuttlebutt, if not the vibe, after the Emmys came down.
An interesting thing about the Emmys is that so far, there has never been a period where a single company dominated for many years in a row. That you might have a streak of, you know, 2 or 3 years where you do really well. But it was often the case that the Grand Slam was a different company every year. Chaosium had a couple in there, but they were spaced out. And so it'll be interesting to see if we're now looking at a world of people with audiences in the millions sending people to the Emmys. Will they be able to crystallize that and make that a permanent thing where they're always winning? Or will this be yet another sort of exciting one night and then next year it'll be a whole other surprise altogether? So the Emmys is certainly managed, you know, compared to like the Grammys or the or the Emmys, for example, to really mix it up. This is still an example of that, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes in the future. And finally, at Gen Con, we can't stop talking about it without a few little food tips. And I think you've got, why don't you start with the sad news and then go to the good news?
Well, last year, I mentioned my new find, the Whistle Stop Inn, which is a bar that serves food, and the duck wings that it served, the buffalo duck wings that it served there. And this year, I was, you know, doing my R. Crumb strut. I'm like, I'm going to get to Whistle Stop early, beat the rush, and I'm going to get me some duck wings, and that will help me face the day. And I got there, and the duck wings, I was told, are off the menu. They're still on the menu, but you can't get them. And the waitress said that the duck wing source has dried up, that there's no more deals to be had with that duck farm. I don't know what happened to the duck farm. I hope nothing bad. But the duck wings are gone from Whistle Stop.
Well, all the ducks are in the Strait of Hormuz. That's
right,
the problem with
exactly.
That supply chain.
They're jambled up. Sheila's suspicion was they were Canadian ducks and it was a tariff that had taken them out. I said, no, it's a local duck farm. It's in Indiana. Whether or not Indiana has internal tariffs, I can't speak to that question. But either way, no more duck wings at the Whistle Stop. So the only thing the Whistle Stop offers you is a quiet, nearly empty bar incredibly close to Gen Con. So if you need a day beer, that's still the place to go. But if you needed a day beer and duck wings, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but no more.
But you've got to recommend to balance the sadness.
Exactly. Last year, Pellegrin went to Livery, which is a restaurant that is a bit off-site. It's definitely an Uber ride. And this year, my beloved publisher, Hal Mangold, took me to Livery. And rather than go for the main courses, which I did last year, we did an all empanada meal. And that was an insanely good idea. The empanadas were terrific. We had the lamb, we had the steak, and we had the corn crema empanadas. And they were all amazing. They came with cream pepper dipping sauces of one type or another. The poblano crema that came with the lamb, literally, you could just drink that in a goblet and you'd have a good day. They'd put a wonderful lamb empanada in it and you were cooking with gas. So with one hand I take away, the other hand I give. It's just that I'm giving you somewhere that is a good bit farther from the hall than a whistle stop is. So maybe this is for your special night or your I don't want to see anyone in a black t-shirt a day. Get in your rideshare or your friend from Indiana's car and you go off to Livery. And trust me, just don't even pay attention to the main courses. Just stuff yourself to bursting on the empanadas. You will be a happy person.
And none of the empanadas had ducks in them, so immune from supply chain
problems. No, they had no duck empanadas. So it may be a statewide duck shortage that we are dealing with.
Right.
But again, I'm only in that state once a year, so I think they could get it sorted out for first week of August at least.
Right. Well, we've done the food, so we've done Gen Con. Let us head to an exciting commercial and then back to our regularly scheduled segments and or hots.
In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Marysshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Yeah, can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Marysshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked. Remember, you're supposed to be solving a case. Gather some more clues. Question more eccentric locals.
Possibly chase a swan or something.
And slowly piece together the truth.
Now on Backer Kit from Pellegrin Press.
Type Backer Kit and Marysshire into your favorite search engine to find the campaign page.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of the ghost of my father welcomes us once more into the gaming hut, where we are in front of, and perhaps behind, Hamlet's GM screen. Once more, we return to Elsinore instead of Mom's basement, and once more, we are looking at story beats in conventional or regular or common or usual parts of the game experience itself. So rather than doing story beats for Hamlet, we're doing story beats for Todd's game.
Right.
And Todd opens the scene in various ways.
But first, let's complete the circuit on the plug.
Okay.
Because Hamlet's GM screen, of course, is my new book that does exactly that, that applies the beat analysis of Hamlet's hit points to moments at the gaming table. And you can pre-order it now, or perhaps even order it, depending on when you hear this, from Pellegrin Press. So to set the scene, we're setting the scene. Players have their mission. Last time they talked about what they wanted to do, possibly which scene they wanted to go to. And you're now beginning to introduce scenes to them. That's something that you'll do through the course of any game session that has any sort of story element to it. And even, in fact, opening a door in a dungeon when you open the door, you're setting the scene. It might be, and you're attacked by centipede folk. And then afterwards, you set the scene. But in general, there's scene setting throughout F20 and sandbox play. It's maybe possibly even more important in sandbox play when you go, well, let's go over to the ridge. What do we see? And then you deliver to them what it is that's over the ridge. And so story beats play a big role in this, as they do in scene setting in any form of writing, whether it's an establishing shot in a movie or descriptive prose in a novel. And therefore, you have tools at your disposal that you can reach into the broader corpus of narrative. For example, the most famous of them is pathetic fallacy. We had a whole segment once about how weird a term this is, but what it means essentially is that the outer environment creates what I would call bring down beats that make things seem scary, or gratification beats if you want the world to seem great. And so, for example, if you're in a modern horror game and the way to get to the place that you need to look at, which is a forlorn warehouse, is you find it on Google Maps. And so when you arrive, that is a moment of excitement. That's an upbeat where you've succeeded procedurally doing something relatively simple. And since it's often difficult to get to the scene in adventure, getting there rather easily can play as an exciting new thing. But then you describe that you're on a winding, exurban street. There's a drizzling downpour, it's chilly, and all of a sudden, no, there's your bring down beat. The players are starting to feel down because they're imagining a grim gray situation. They're feeling the cold. You reinforce that by describing their destination as gray and wet, the gray warehouse. And you will inevitably, in any scene, have a certain number of beats that you're just answering perhaps unasked questions, providing a description of what it is exactly you are, because you need the players to be able to picture that. You could argue that those are lateral beats because they're not yet full of emotional information, or you can argue that any information, even to a question that hasn't been asked, is a positive because it's causing the players to imagine what it is that's going on in the world, and that's a good and a fun part of play. But as you're describing the warehouse, its general size, the fact that it fills a whole lot, the fact that it's surrounded by a big parking lot with no cars in it and a chain link fence. But if you notice that as you're rattling off details of this place and the players do not seem like they're gratified by this information, but are starting to tune out because people tune out surprisingly quickly, which is the theme of this book, you can then add an emotional detail. Okay, so these are just, this is a little too straightforward. So stuck to the fence, there's these rattling paper bags that remind you of the groan of ghosts. And they're, okay, there we go. We've got something emotional to chew on again. It's a downbeat, but it's also an engagement beat because it makes the situation seem terrible and awful and scary. Do you have other tricks that you use, Ken, when you're introducing players to a new foreboding scene?
Well, as you say, the pathetic fallacy is a good one. So the weather, that's a classic bit that you can use that goes back to, you know, Walpole, if not considerably before that. But if it's a scary thing, it's probably cold, it's probably wet, the sky is gray, or if it's at night, then you can say that there's a fog and so you can't even see any stars, or it's a new moon and so everything's very dark. If that's the mood you want to set, you can do that. For a little excitement, you can have some rumbling thunder in the distance that maybe is going to get closer, maybe not. To add a note of speed it up, you could say that the streets are full of slush and every now and again a car comes by and splashes you with it. And so the notion is, all right, we have to go into the warehouse as much as we hate this. Another good one is the architecture often lets you do a pathetic fallacy as well. So you can say for your warehouse, you can say that the row of windows at the top of the walls, it's under a hanging eave, so it looks like a man peering suspiciously at you. And that, you know, it's just the most naked of pathetic fallacies, but it does work. You know, you say that, or you can describe if you're trying to get them excited, you say the exterior of the Venetian palazzo is worked in precious stones and exotic metals. The family that lives in this house has got so much money, they're putting it on the outside of the palazzo as well as on the inside. And that gets everyone rubbing their hands together and thinking, we're going to make so much money when we knock this place over. So
yes, where are the guards for this gold? Oh, they're big burly guards. Oh, downbeat.
Oh, no. Or there don't seem to be any guards. And then it's like, all right, okay, then that's a watchfulness beat.
There's invisible shimmers near the gold columns. Uh-huh. The opposite of this, of course, is the bucolic prelude. When you introduce a negative, scary environment, that foreboding place is the problem. When you introduce something that's beautiful and sun-dappled, you are indicating to the seasoned consumer of narrative that they're being set up for a turnaround. So your Yellow King characters can be at the park. You can say, oh, it's a balmy spring day. Your families and couples are picnicking. They're chattering at the light. There's another upbeat. That's another gratification beat. And you say, in fact, you're at Le Grand Jatte. It's exactly the scene from the famous Seurat painting. It's like, oh, that's great. We get to imagine ourselves being in 1890s Paris. This is fabulous. And then up ahead, you see a couple of familiar figures, and that introduces a question that shows them, oh, here, there's something to interact with. And the question is both exciting, but also there's an element of something unresolved about it. So that's an ambiguous beat. And the player says, do I know who that is? And, oh, it's Claude Monet and Alfred Sisley. And then again, they get the upbeat from you revealing that, again, they're interacting with arts figures in Belle Epoque Paris. And therefore, that's all part of the deal. The promise of the game is being paid off. And then Monet smiles at them. He's inviting conversation. And there we go. That's very exciting. And then, of course, you're going to find an arm drift up onto the island. And there's your surprise bit of horror that is really not a surprise if you were thinking for a moment about what game you're in and what was being set up. And then you're off to the races. And you've had that moment of contrasting happiness ahead of time to lull you for the horror. And I think we tend to think of, from the very first scene settings that we encountered, like old D&D modules where it's about the thorny entrance to the dungeon, I think we tend to underrate the possibility of the idyllic beginning that is going to lead into horror. But that's another sharp way to start a scene that makes full use of narrative beats.
And if you are set up to have famous GMCs, especially ones the characters want to interact with, that itself is an upbeat. I recognize Claude Monet. Maybe my character doesn't, but I personally, I know that he's a famous painter and I'm excited to meet him in game. That's great. In my Western game, the players had a similar yet opposite reaction to seeing Wyatt Earp come out of the pool hall. And I said, oh, that's Wyatt Earp. And then there's an immediate discussion as to, do we meet and greet Wyatt Earp, or would we like to stay completely off of his radar while we're here in Tombstone? But that gets them into the world in a way that sometimes a generic GMC takes a little while to do. The generic GMC has to appeal to them or shoot at them or do something to provoke an emotional reaction, an up or a downbeat. Whereas if they recognize the person, and this also works with a GMC who's local famous in your game, your players have already met and heard of them. So they've been fearing the necromancer and here he is showing up at the tavern. They're like, oh, that's not good. But again, if you don't have a famous necromancer and you say the door to the tavern swings open and in walks Joseph Kerwin, you have a moment and everyone is excited because this is a thing that obviously is signaling something important. It's like seeing a guest star on a TV show who you recognize from other shows. You know they're going to be important to the plot because they wouldn't just have Gene Hackman on to tell you that, nope, we haven't seen anyone like that around. Sorry. You know that something real is going to go down.
Right. And so you are introducing things that are fleshing out what the problem is that they're dealing with, what the possibility of where they're going is. And so you're creating an anticipation for more development. And as you suggest, sometimes a famous GMC, fictional or otherwise, creates an ambiguous beat because it's like, oh, do I really want to talk to this person? Even if it's just Claude Monet, will he be mean to me in front of his easel?
I'm calling my patron Portrait of a Dork, and it is yeah.
Yes. The dark is very well lit.
Yeah. Well, the worst part is he's going to paint like 17 pictures of you in different lighting. It's going to be known as the Dork series. It's awful.
Right. Another thing that you are going to look to want to do with narrative beats when setting a scene is laying in information, what in the system is called a pipe beat out of screenwriter jargon, where in and amongst the details that you're presenting that feel to the players, just like you're orienting them, you're talking about the situation, you're giving them the information they will need to then grab the scene and begin to interact with it, you can sneak in a detail that will be important later. And so, for example, the characters have landed on their shuttlecraft on the foreboding planet. They exit the shuttle. The air is breathable. Oh boy, that's always a great moment in space opera where you can take off your stupid helmets. And then you look up at the sky and, oh, it's green and disorienting. It's like, oh, this is maybe not as good as the air. And then you can sort of start to lay in, oh, there's a outcrop that you've landed on. It's granite light rock because the conceit, especially in science fiction, is, you know, everybody's got their science instruments out and they're measuring things. And so they're doing a core activity of being space opera explorers. And in there, you can, after providing what seems, what is actually an irrelevant detail, that the outcrop is made of granite, it's relevant to the character who goes, oh yeah, this is granite, don't worry about it. And then you can say, well, there's pulverized shell scattered across the top of the rock. And then you can glance over that. But later on, that will turn out to be important because there'll be shell on the bottom of somebody's boot, so you know that they've been here, for example. And if the characters ask a little bit about that, that's fine too. You don't need to sneak this fully past them, but you've now established something that you can pay off later in the scene. And so that's sort of an advanced technique when you're setting the stage for what's going on. Also plant something that is relevant, not immediately, but hopefully a little later on.
And it can be as easy as, you know, you're at the old mansion on the coast of Massachusetts, you hear the tide going out. And it's like, okay, that's normal. We get that. But what that means is the players are now subconsciously know at some point tide's going to come in. And that's when the deep ones are all coming in on the tide and they're going to, you know, invade the mansion and do their awful blasphemies there. So even something that is legitimately an innocuous beat can lay pipe or lay expectation pipe for the bad thing that's about to happen. And that's lovely when you can make that happen.
Well, speaking of making things happen, now that we've set the scene for the rest of the adventure, it's time for us to head off in a completely different direction for a different hut and or segment.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep this podcast in both breakfasts alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Lee Candelino,
Luke Steyer,
Peter Atkison,
Chihiro Yamada,
and Chris Farrell.
The rattle of the pans on the range top, the crack of eggs into the bowl, and the quack, 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 quack of the whisk, the beautiful smells pouring up out of the cooking food welcome us, even embrace us, as we enter the food hut. Possibly one of the best huts, certainly the best smelling hut here on the campus. And so in the food hut, well, I guess we're hungry. We're so hungry that we can eat two breakfasts because we've already breakfasted spiritually on the Merryshire Detective Club backer kit. We've fed ourselves with the anticipation of that coming. The campaign ends August 22nd. Go to backer kit. Search for Merryshire Detective Club. Ah! But, oh, after all that exertion, what better to do than sit down to a delicious breakfast? Robin, don't you think so?
Yes, indeed. And so if you think of halflings and halfling breakfast, the immediate question, of course, that comes to mind is what goes in first breakfast and what goes in second breakfast? And of course, one could answer, well, just whatever's around. And surely the halflings of the riding do not restrict themselves completely to two separate meals. You go with what's seasonal, you go with what's ready, but you've got an abundant array of choices. And that is because in the riding, you live in a super abundant rural economy because the mysterious beings known as them have created a shield of comfort and normalcy in an otherwise scary wider world in which you dwell in just bucolic happiness, in which you are rarely ever troubled by anything except for all the murders. But other than that, you live in a situation where the fruits of your agricultural economy are kept within your small community. So you don't have raiders coming from outside to raid your farms, which is a problem that farmers have in a typical fantasy world or in history until rather recently. You don't have the supply demands of war. You don't have your own king coming and taking all of your food in order to fight a war, or worse, an invading enemy army taking all of your food. That doesn't happen in the riding. It's protected from that. Nor do you even have sort of an oppressive noble who is just taxing you. You have a sort of a friendly squire who's kind of on your level in what is kind of an egalitarian society where there's just a lot of food. And so you are able to eat a lot of food. As halflings, you can eat more food probably than a human or a dwarf or other people bigger than you. You are admirably round. But even so, given the amount of food you pack away, you must have a faster than human metabolism in order to pack all those calories away. I don't know if evolution exists in the riding. It's not something you probably discuss. It's outside of your frame of reference, but maybe you have evolved to absorb all of the calories that your place produces.
Excess calories either go to the murdering gland or the detecting gland.
One of those two glands. Yeah, there's very few detectives in town, so.
Right. Must go to the murdering gland.
Yeah, it's got to be. So basically, this is an idealized English society that's sort of Victorian, sort of Edwardian, also, of course, has a heavy element of fantasy to it. And everybody is basically eating like an English lord. And so in our history of breakfast in England, it starts kind of with the morning feast that nobles would sometimes give to the people in their household when they're just starting out, possibly as a follow-up to an evening feast. We don't know. And the breakfast, as we kind of know it, kind of starts in the 13th century. And that's because it's needed for labor. And just like the halflings who need to go off and do farm work, laborers on farms had to go off and expend a lot of calories in order to get more calories back from whatever it was they were doing, whether it was planting or harvesting or shearing sheep or what have you.
And this goes to your point that the 13th century is the first, the late 13th, is the first bit of England for probably 200 years that hasn't had some sort of civil war going on in it. They had the anarchy they had before that, William's conquest and the reconquests. It's just England itself is insanely naturally fertile. They have multiple growing seasons, and in a place with no summer, this seems wild, but the endless rain produces, of course, insanely fertile fields. And so you can get two or even three harvests out of some English farms. So they are naturally overproducing food, similarly to stuff in the south of France under the rain shadow of the Juras, or in better yet, Atlantic France. They overproduce food immensely, which is part of the reason that the French peasants of this era, not quite the 13th century, they're fighting the English. But once the French peasant gets 2 seconds to breathe, suddenly you have a similar blossoming of food options, and it's because this stretch of Northwest Europe is just insanely, insanely fertile. And again, you get the same effect in farms in America, in the Midwest, which once more we have just crazily fertile soil, so lots and lots of food surplus. So the American farm breakfast that becomes the American diner breakfast, a different fantasy than our halflings, produces the same sort of outcome. And so just to take it down to the soil for a bit and then move us back, as you say, into the manor house sitting above and on the soil.
Right. So by the 1770s, there are things that are recognizably being served by English lords to their guests that seem like the foundations of what we would call breakfast, or the origins of the English full breakfast. And so by the Victorian era, it's gone all the way down to the lower middle classes who we need to feed up so they can work. And so they're urged to plump up and get healthy with a full breakfast. And by the late 19th century, affordable breakfasts are available in cafes. And so this raises the question of where the halflings are eating their breakfast. They can be cooking at home and serving them to the rest of the detective clubs, or they might be off in their favorite tavern having a breakfast, which would certainly be a big, busy food hall with people coming and going. And presumably, even a small halfling village supports a number of different breakfast halls. And at about this point, we're, of course, imagining that the halflings have eggs to go with their bacon, and that puts them on a level of abundance that's equivalent to the early 20th century U.S., because the full English breakfast does not really become that until everybody has access to eggs, which is relatively new in food history. Even perhaps somewhat more surprising, the other elements of what we think of as the very traditional English full breakfast come relatively late. So potatoes, originally they would be refried potatoes, but now, you know, there's such a demand for them that they'll be made fresh. That enters the full breakfast after the breaking of post-war austerity, so in the 50s. And many of the things that, especially us non-UK people, think of as the specific hallmarks of the English breakfast don't really enter until the 60s and 70s. So that's the addition of mushrooms, tomatoes, the grilled tomato, the black pudding, and Ken, your enemy, the baked bean.
Right, my hated foe.
And all of those things, it's not like they're invented in the 60s and 70s, but they become part of the assumption of what is a full English. And my last bit of food history in our world that I'll get to is, or I guess segueing back to halflings, is that the English are somewhat abashed about the full breakfast being the dish they have most exported to the rest of the world. A lot of dishes were imported to England, but the one that everybody thinks of as specifically English is the full breakfast. And I think there's some eye rolling from UK people about that. But, you know, there are times. I mean,
they tried to ruin it. They put baked beans in it, but we just didn't listen.
Right. So we have to decide now, predominantly, one way or the other, whether a particular thing that has appeared at the English breakfast table in different periods of history is in the first or second breakfast, mostly with all of the situational caveats that we've got to before. So Ken, beef. We don't normally now think of beef as a big breakfast item. We say that for later in the day, but halflings got to eat what they got to eat. And if there's some beef on hand, they're going to eat it. But are they going to eat it in first or second breakfast?
I think that beef is a classic first breakfast because first breakfast, as you alluded, begins as the leftover fruit from last night. You're getting up. You need quick energy, mostly to cook second breakfast. And so you go to the larder or you go to the ice box and you open it up, and in there, there's going to be the rest of the joint from last night. And that might be beef, as you say, that might be mutton, that might even be pork, depending on what you had last night, but it's going to be there. And so you, ideally, there's a French bone sticking out. You can just pick up and gnaw on. But if you're going to put a plate together, you take it, you scrape it off. Maybe you fry it up in a little fat in the pan, but maybe you just eat it cold. Cold beef is pretty delicious, especially if you're just getting up and you need that hit of protein.
Right. You can dunk it in the tomato sauce from your beans.
Right.
Now we come to bread. Bread, obviously, a trick question. You're going to need that both first and second breakfast, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The bread is going to be, I think, in varying forms, right? You might have the sort of leftover dinner rolls with first breakfast. And then by second breakfast, you're actually doing proper toast because you've got the toasting fork out and you can make it happen. And then maybe you're putting cheese on the toast. Maybe you're just having the toast with your marmalade or whatever. But that's a second breakfast item because, again, unlike the English, the halflings eat toast warm, not air temperature. They don't have the toast rack. You just have toast.
Right, because it's a paradisical setting, not a cold toast setting.
Exactly.
Next, we come to an item that would be part of an earlier breakfast because of its calorie content. So I don't even necessarily know if the calorie abundant world of halfling breakfast includes it, but that would be ale. I kind of think that just very specifically rustic halflings would have ale, and that would tell you something about their personalities. That I'm guessing that this is probably not a staple of every halfling at every breakfast.
I feel like as long as we're making the halfling breakfast paradise, we can import an American breakfast staple from rural America and have cider instead of ale. I think that that, because every American farm had more apples than they knew what to do with, and they would put them into the cider house, and then they would get pressed down and be turned into delicious, delicious cider, which would begin sweet and then ferment as time went on. So, you know, how sweet or fermented your cider is, I guess, is an individual halfling choice. But I'd like to put cider in there for our breakfast beverage.
Right.
And again, that's a both. That's not an either.
Right. And that will feel a sort of, you know, West Country-like, especially to Americans, because now cider's a bigger deal in the UK than it is now. The heyday of cider went away in the US when beer
prohibition became, among other things.
Right. But it was eclipsed earlier by beer because,
yeah.
But anyway, that's a whole other food hut. Now we come to the trinity of pork dishes, your ham, your bacon, your sausage. A full breakfast will often include all three of those things, I'm going to import a Canadian US thing to my ideal halfling breakfast, which is strip bacon. And I think that halflings know how to make bacon in a way that a contemporary English cafe does not.
It would be fun if the various halfling families each have their own type of bacon. So one of them has strip bacon, one of them has streaky bacon, one of them has, you know, basically pork belly. So they're the Korean halflings. I mean, if you're going to be known for eating well, you should have pork belly type bacon. And then, you know, a pancetta halfling. What the heck? Let's go crazy. I think everyone should have their own bacon. But yes, bacon.
Right. And that's probably, you're going to have a bunch of that in first breakfast, but some will be left over for second breakfast. So that'll be a crossover event.
Well, at the very least, you need to make bacon grease to fry second breakfast in. And the only way to do that, my friends, is to fry bacon. So even if you thought it didn't belong in first breakfast, you have to eat it in first breakfast because you're using bacon grease for second breakfast.
Right. And because you need bacon grease for second breakfast, I'm going to say that for halflings, the eggs are mostly in second breakfast.
Yes, I think that you're right. I think maybe some halfling families have made boiled eggs, and so that you got the little row of hard-boiled eggs. You can eat those with first breakfast, but your poached, scrambled, fried, however your hot, fresh-cooked eggs are, those are, even your soft-boiled eggs in the little cup, if you're a fancy halfling, those are all going to be second breakfast. I think you're right there.
Potatoes, I think they were left over from the night before, so they're going to be eaten up in first breakfast.
There may be another frying for second breakfast, but I feel like those are more likely to become potato pancakes of whatever sort, boxed tea or latke, depending on if your halflings are more Irish or Jewish, but it's basically the same thing.
Since you don't have that source of starch, I think baked beans, all you have to do is heat those up. So they're probably first breakfast.
Yeah. I think that, again, those are left over from the night before. They're from the bean course or the bean soup. You heat those up. Maybe what you do, as we've mentioned, is you take a big old hunk of ham and you take the ham and you let that heat up by cooking in the baked beans. And then the baked beans taste better. And also you've got a warm ham for your first breakfast.
Right. The mushrooms, I think the aspiration is to have the mushrooms in first breakfast, but the boggarts who farm the mushrooms are often a little late in showing up because they're hungry, sure, but they're not as hungry as halflings, and so they're not quite as attuned to the need for first breakfast. So they may ramble in at what they think is first breakfast, but is actually a second.
And the other thing is, if you got leftover mushrooms, those can be eaten in first breakfast just fine. But yeah, the fresh sliced, cooked in the bacon grease, that's clear second breakfast activity.
The grilled tomatoes, I'm thinking, are you don't have the bacon grease yet, and you don't need bacon grease to grill a tomato per se. So maybe you're going to do those on the grill pans in first breakfast, and then you will have room for the other stuff you need to fry up later.
I think one of the questions is, did you have a tomato handy in your icebox, or do you have to go out to the glass house and get your tomato? If you have it handy, yes, you're absolutely right. If you have to go out to the glass house, well, you needed the first breakfast energy to get you to walk 45 steps into your glass house and get a tomato down. So that's just... it's just dependent, I guess.
In a fantasy world, there's two kinds of black pudding, but they yes. keep the monstrous kind out. So you only have the delicious sort of pseudo-sausagey one to deal with. And I'm going to say that since that's a cured item that's ready to go, I think that's optional. Different households will have it either at first or at second breakfast.
Right, yeah.
If first breakfast seems a little, you know, insufficient somehow for some reason, you can throw in the black pudding then, or you can hold it for second.
It might be dependent on, you know, when are you having your tomatoes and mushrooms as well. You want to do that trinity, put them all together. And that probably means, as we've suggested, second breakfast.
Then there's a question of the fish dish. your village may be on the sea or near a lake. And so it may be that you are adding kippers or grilled sardines. I think probably that is more of an exotic thing. It's outside of the bacon realm. And I think that's going to be held for second breakfast. And if you need it for first breakfast, you're probably going for a smoked one rather than frying one fresh.
Right, yeah. There's going to be a good number of kippers. In every English mystery story, all the country house mysteries, they come down for breakfast on the morning after the murder. And one of the things they say is, no one has touched their kippers, which apparently is meant to indicate the house is sad, not that the house had other better things to eat for breakfast. So I feel like kippers are going to be there. And as you say, since there are smoked ones, they could be with either one. So it's really going to be a personal choice. You know, when do you want your kippers? Or maybe they took them out for first breakfast and the kipper box is still sitting on the table for second breakfast, if you feel like it. I don't know if we are so paradisical as to have smoked salmon available, since that's now a breakfast food in much of America and even in some lucky parts of Britain. But if they are, I feel like smoked salmon is a second breakfast because it is a delicious fatty luxury. And that's what you're thinking of by the time you've got your brain around second breakfast. And you're like, what else can we do? We can make delicious smoked salmon. And I noticed that we don't have muffins yet, but an English muffin. Surely if we're doing pretend England, we can do the pretend English muffin. And once you've got that, then I think muffins are a second breakfast item because that's where you're putting your marmalade that you didn't already put on your toast.
You may all collectively decide that your village is a little bit variant. You might be pseudo-Welsh, in which case you're going to add barilar, a seaweed puree, and cockles. Get some shellfish on your menu. If you are pseudo-Scottish halflings, of course, haggis will add to your menu. And if you're pseudo-Midlands, the oat cake, which is a savory cake, because it is savory, I think goes in first breakfast. Beverage-wise, we've already covered ale. Tea is going to be, there's teapots all over the graphic design. It's going to be your default English thing. And perhaps the weird halflings who have gone out into the wider world and been coarsened are perhaps drinkers of coffee.
And I think that a halfling who sets store by being hospitable to everyone will have coffee available, even if they don't usually drink it themselves. That'll be like, well, often travelers enjoy coffee for some reason. I should have it available.
Yeah, we like that guy who came and asked us for coffee until all the murders started.
Until the murders began.
Now, maybe I'm blinkered by the savory sweet barrier, but my instinct is that the sweet breakfast items happen in second breakfast. So those would be your pancakes, your waffles, your French toast. Fresh fruit might be, there might be some grapes or apple slices in first breakfast, but your fruit cup, I think, is going to happen in second breakfast, along with your scones, your croissants, your crumpets. And this is the fast rush of sugar you need before you're really going to get out and get on with your day, whether you're farming, whether you're building a wall or detecting and finding out what happened with the latest murder.
Yeah, I think that all of those, certainly the first three, require the concentration that a second breakfast requires. The pancakes, waffles, and French toast, you can't just sort of slap those out. If you had a leftover roll or something with dinner, that's not going to cut it for second breakfast. You'll have eaten it up with your first breakfast beef or whatever. In the fresh fruit world, I think the only exception is if you have apples. You might eat an apple with first breakfast. And then, as you say, the fruit cup, the lovingly prepared fruit cup, that's going to be a definite second breakfast item.
Well, now that we've covered all of these important details, I'm getting a little hungry. So, Ken, let's turn off the recording for a little while, eat a second breakfast, and then come back for another exciting hot indoor segment.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to stop on the landing and wave to the portrait of the fire salamander. As a good elemental, he's going to wave back, and then we're going to drift on in to the parlor of the consulting colossus. He's not really in an Edwardian getup this time around. He's kind of got a 60s vibe happening because he's wearing sort of a paisley Nehru jacket, because he has got this request from Dave from Washington, who asks, "Please have Ken and Robin talk about Michael Aquino, the most cardist thing I have seen all year." So, Ken, this is an interesting crossover between military psyops and Satanism. Mm-hmm. And it all starts with someone born in 1946. And you guessed it, everybody, San Francisco.
That's right. Michael Aquino is born in San Francisco. He's the son of a Third Army World War II vet. He is, in many ways, a almost stereotypical boomer. He's a baby boom guy, and so everything that goes wrong with a baby boom, I think, happens to him at some point or another. They move to Santa Barbara, the family does. That's where he graduates high school. He's an Eagle Scout. Idyllic childhood, check. Goes to University of California, Santa Barbara. Goes ROTC, so check again. And when he graduates, he's commissioned. He goes to the 82nd Airborne, gets jump training, special forces training at the JFK School at Fort Bragg, and on his way to Vietnam, back from Fort Bragg, he stops off in San Francisco, his home, and he goes to the premiere of Rosemary's Baby, where he meets Anton LaVey, and Anton LaVey impresses him. He started getting into existentialism on his own reading, and he's like, oh, life is meaningless, this is terrible, good thing I'm going to Vietnam, I guess. And then he meets LaVey, and LaVey says, no, life has meaning because you are a god. You determine whether life has meaning for you. And this hits Aquino where he lives, so once more, check and check for the baby boom hearing a dumb guru in the 60s, joins the Church of Satan. And we talked about Anton LaVey in episode 15, if people want a real throwback. Marries his first wife, Janet, who is a former Mormon, and then goes off to Vietnam, where he serves one tour as a psychological warfare officer, a psych war officer. He sees a lot of combat. He earns the Bronze Star, which is not nothing at all. And among the things that he does, according to a later report by occultist Stephen Flowers, experiments to disorient Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers by using amplified sounds, sometimes complete with demonic screams, blaring from helicopters flying over their heads, which makes me think maybe he got in touch with either Edwin Lansdale or one of the people doing Lansdale's good work later on, because that's classic Lansdale-style psyops. 1971, he comes back to the States. He is ordained a satanic priest, and because LaVey is looking for people to join the Church of Satan who are not completely useless, Aquino rises rapidly in the ranks.
Your military organizational skills? Here's the newsletter.
Here's the newsletter. He edits the newsletter, The Cloven Hoof. He rises to the ruling Council of Nine. He writes the explicitly Lovecraftian Ceremony of the Nine Angles and Call to Cthulhu that go into the satanic rituals. He's still in the U.S. Army Reserve. He also, at some point in the 70s, becomes a stockbroker with Merrill Lynch. And so, if you're asking, where does he get his money? I guess that's where, in addition to his military pay.
Yeah, he's getting the whole satanic quadrant in.
And then, depending on your source, and two credible sources give two different dates, he breaks with LaVey either in 72 or 75, but it's over LaVey's plan to sell ranks in the Church of Satan. And Aquino says, you can't do that. And LaVey said, did you forget the part where I'm a god? And he says, but this is dumb and cheap and makes you look terrible, makes Satan look bad. How dare you? And LaVey says, oh, I'm sorry. Did you not get the memo? Satan is made up. We're just doing this as a bit.
This is circus. You didn't realize this was circus?
And Aquino says, Satan is definitely not made up. He dictated a book to me while I was in Vietnam. I'm out of here. So they quit over LaVey's simony and unbelief, which adds a lovely early medieval touch to all of this. So anyway, Aquino is out of the Church of Satan. He is bereft. So he decides to ask Satan what to do. And Satan says, oh, Satan, that's just the stage name. Call me Set. That's my real name. And also, good thing you asked. Here's a book for you. And Aquino then channels from Satan the Book of Coming Forth by Night, which coincidentally says, my instructions to you, Michael Aquino, are to found the Temple of Set and become high priest of it. And so that's what he does. His military career is continuing. His academic career is continuing. He gets a master's degree in political science from UC Santa Barbara. 1979, he resigns as the high priest of the Temple of Set. He figures he's set it up. It can go by itself. He's done his job. 1980, also, he's got a doctoral thesis to defend. He gets his PhD, again, in political science. Writes his thesis on the neutron bomb, which is political science in the sense of security studies, I guess, but it seems like a weird thing to do. By now, he's in the 7th PSYOP group at the Presidio in San Francisco. That's his main posting. He's a major in the active reserve guard. And with his commanding officer, a guy named Colonel Paul Vallely, co-authors From PSYOP to Mind War, The Psychology of Victory, which becomes a very influential paper in how the United States military treats psychological operations. So that's, you know, he's got three careers going and all of them are going well. I mean, he's just an adjunct professor of political science at Golden Gate, but it's still a thing. 1981, he becomes a Defense Intelligence Agency attaché. So people who are waiting for him to connect to the formal intelligence system, there we are. 1982, he goes to the Foreign Service Institute. And also serves as a NATO liaison in various European countries. And while NATO liaisoning in Germany, goes to Himmler's old Black Castle Wewelsburg. And he goes and he finds Himmler's Sanctum Sanctorum, crawls down into it. There's not a sign. He finds it with his Satan powers. And he does a satanic working there.
Yeah, just typical NATO liaison stuff.
Like you do. He doesn't do it on the job. He doesn't bring anybody else. This is during his own time.
Yeah.
Then, I guess Satan has said, first of all, call me Set. Second of all, why did you leave the temple? It's useless without you. So he goes back and takes it back over. And he realizes he needs people who are dedicated to the Aquino vision to help run Set Temple. And so he takes the old security team, the old Church of Satan security team, the Order of the Trapezoid, and reforms it as a chivalric order, according to him's words, within the Temple of Set. So if you need Setite Templars, there we are, Order of the Trapezoid. Surely this is enough game material for anyone, but no. In 1986, he marries a former Church of Satan priestess, Lilith Sinclair. She left about the time that he did, over the same reasons, so they had that in common. I was not able to find out when he and Jenny broke up, but I assume sometime during the Temple of Set era. In 1987, in kind of a dark irony, he is falsely accused of satanic child molestation at a daycare in San Francisco that's run by the military. It was a different guy that did it. They found him. He wasn't even in San Francisco at the time. He was in Washington, D.C. There's zero evidence behind this. And I want to emphasize this because you're going to play all kinds of games with Michael Aquino, and he leaves himself open to all of them, not least with the fun way he wears his eyebrows. But that is legitimately not true. So leave that part of the fun to somebody else. But the stink around it means the Army transfers him to St. Louis, Missouri, to run the Army Reserve Personnel Record System. And he still does other stuff for the military. He claims that he's been working with Space Command. In 1990, he leaves the active guard, but he's still part-time Army Reserve. And then in 1994, he retires from the Army entirely as a lieutenant colonel. So which means, to those who are paying attention, he retired as a major, got bumped up to lieutenant colonel, because that's what they do when you retire. You get the one last bump, assuming you're in good color with your commanding officer. And so he gets to go out as a light colonel, meaning a nicer pension. And also he has a meritorious service ribbon, which means that during that whole time of long service, no one ever found anything wrong with his military work. So that's Good to know. In 1996, again, he tries to step down from active Temple of Set leadership. That works until a psycho tries to take over in 2002. And I know what you're asking, Robin. How would a psycho want to take over the Temple of Set? It doesn't track, but I guess, you know, even the most stringent of application processes breaks down. So he goes back in, saves the temple one last time. In 2004, after he leaves the temple, he applies to become the 13th Baron Rakan, or Rachane, R-A-C-H-A-N-E, which is a Scots noble title that has been left in abeyance by, I assume, the rising of 1745, but they're still selling it, so he gets to be a baron. And then in 2013, he expands that 1980 paper into the book Mind War, which, in addition to proposing do the psychological warfare stuff before you start the war, and it'll be easier to get them to surrender, that was basically the theory of the first paper, is, well, now that we have science, we can do involuntary psych controls with subliminal conditioning, brainwave resonance that you can transmit through a satellite or the internet. You can make all the computers and TVs and phones in the area radiate brainwave frequencies. You can use magnetic fields to alter people's judgment. You can engage in an operational conditioning tool depending on how much you can change the built environment. He suggests atmospheric ionization, color shapes, which is old LaVey stuff, chronobiology, which I think is messing with your time sense, architecture, so psychogeography, and EM fields. Those will all help you condition a population. And then mentalism, which is not meaning telepathy. What it means is the pattern that accompanies stage mentalism, where you convince people, instead of that there was magic, you convince them there was not magic. So they come out of all this stuff and they think, man, I feel weird. And then the mentalist says, no, you don't. That was just normal. That was just Tuesday. And then you run this all from a really cool command center full of brainwave frequency ionization and stuff. So this is all in his new book, Mind War. And every military scholar who talks about Mind War says, we endorse the 1980 paper. We do not endorse the 2013 paper. And by the way, all that's impossible. So, Shane, don't pay attention to how bright and flashy your phone is. In 2019, he dies after a long illness. The Temple of Set covers it up for a year, which I think is another great touch. But that is Michael Aquino. He goes out, as he lived, a weirdo. And again, people will drag him into stuff. But there is a British Satanist neo-Nazi group called the Order of the Nine Angles that's got no connection to Aquino or the Temple of Set. Those are different guys. They're very bad. But anything Michael Aquino got up to was not this. So pay attention. And again, it's not like he hasn't given you more than enough to play with, from his early Fall of Delta Green days all the way down to basically establishing Esoterror Ops Manual 1. So, Robin, what are you going to do with Michael Aquino now that we have this vast quantity of lore?
Well, the interesting thing about him is that, you know, he's a Satanist with principles, right? That he's a weirdo, but I wouldn't want to... I would want the psycho guy who tried to take over the Temple of Set be the one who takes all of his ideas and begins to use them to contact the outer dark. And, you know, maybe this Set character who's in communication with him is a being from the outer dark, but I guess a fictionalized version of him we could turn into a supervillain. But I think it is more interesting to leave him as an ambiguous figure who straddles all of these different scenes. So maybe he's deep into the Ordo Veritatis. Maybe he's learning all of this stuff in order to, you know, he's possibly a counter-esoterror operative.
Mr. Verity shows up and he's got cool curled eyebrows.
Right. Certainly, though, a lot of the stuff that he talks about in Mind War has been taken up either through parallel evolution, but I would suspect in some instances by people reading his book, because a lot of that is straight up, you know, 5G paranoia now. And yeah, if someone with his background wrote a book saying all of these things are possible or will soon be possible, if you have a paranoid worldview, it doesn't take you very long to just go, oh yeah, that's happening and it's happening to me. And this is why I have these weird thoughts. This is why we have to be afraid of the 5G towers, or I guess increasingly now the data centers are now beginning to acquire a lot of the qualities that we are setting up here. So you could play with the idea that the esoterists, for example, are setting up a data center in order to engage in brainwave resonance. It's not really about LLMs at all. It's about having a installation in every city that allows them to beam out information. And so that could be a thing they're really doing or a hoax to bring people in. And for their purposes, that would have the same effect.
And what struck me about this guy is he's very much the left-hand path version of Jim Channon, the guy who famously is the man who stared at goats and sets up the First Earth Battalion and is trying to do this sort of hippy-dippy new age version of the military. And so I love the idea that the Army funded both of them on a ground of, well, let's see which one works better for, you know, destabilizing foreign targets. First Earth Battalion gives us entirely integrated super soldiers, but Set's ability to control minds is also pretty good. So we're going to stick with Aquino, too. I love the notion that these two figures are both rising in the military basically at the same time. Channon is a little later than Aquino, which even is more interesting in a way. But the parallel's there. So if you wanted the men who worship goats as a even different military operation to be the evil twin of your good yet hapless Operation Stargate, I think this gives you the raw material for that.
I feel like because it is so obvious, we jump too quickly over the Fall of Delta Green implications of somebody who is designing invocations to Cthulhu at the same time as his helicopter is giving out demonic screams. Perhaps the ea or the Cthulhu photogons are the what is being screamed, and who knows what he's summoning, so that your Delta Green agents in 69 can get a wind that this is happening. And is he majestic? Is he some weird lone operator who's doing this without authorization? What's going on? And I mean, that's a scenario right there, is the helicopters are screaming chants in unearthly voices.
Well, from regular unearthly helicopters to black helicopters to covert data center mind control, I believe that Michael Aquino stands like a colossus across every dumb idea of the 20th century. But then I said baby boomer at the top of the segment.
So Dave from Washington is right. That is the most cartoonish thing he has seen all year. And having delivered that, we can declare victory in another podcast episode and come back again a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast from departing the scene by joining such backers as
Eric Lauren.
Evan Hughes.
Garrett Fitzgerald.
Hyperlexic.
And Ian Nystrom.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.